we're not going to move away from, you know, being a capitalistic society. And even if we did, I'm not sure that would be the solution. But I think if we, you know, really look at the history of how certain things have come about and invest in those areas that, you know, we've not invested in, you know, the odd thing that's happened in the last, you know, 25 years where we've removed a lot of funding from mental health institutions, and you have a lot of people who have mental health issues on the streets. In some cities, up to 40% of those people are veterans from the last 20 years of war, right? So I think it starts with us acknowledging that some of our lack of attention and lack of investment in these areas has exacerbated these problems, and then having a willingness to actually invest the money in those areas so that we can move forward and this doesn't happen again.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Kermit, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I was actually introduced to you by way of my brother-in-law, who told me about the work that you do and the fact that you're a doctor and you know, that you just have a very interesting background. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, where in the world did you grow up and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
Yeah, so I grew up in South Haven, Michigan, which is a rural community in yes, near Kalamazoo is probably the biggest town there. You know, I would say that the way that it impacted how I look at, I guess rather my viewpoint in terms of my career and how it's guided me is, you know, my family, my wife, I'd say dad and mom met in Chicago in junior college, but then they realized that that's not a place that they would want to raise a kid, because at that time it was just a lot of gangs and a lot of other problems like that. And so my dad came from a rural community in Arkansas. And so he felt one of the best things that he could do for us is kind of raise us in a rural community as far away from that type of violence as he could. So growing up on a farm with, you know, cows and hogs and chickens and, you know, blueberries and all these other types of responsibilities, I think taught me from an early age the value of not just hard work, but the value of a narrative in terms of your life story and how that can kind of propel you forward.
What was the sort of dominant narrative you growing up around your house, particularly growing on up on a farm? Because, you know, I mean, typically somebody who ends up in med school, that's not the trajectory of where they end up. They're usually like, you know, the parents of kids who are scientists or something like, you know, or the kids of parents who are scientists, something like that. I think it's just such an interesting background to come from to end up where you did.
You know, a little bit more background on me would be that my mom is a nurse. She, before that, was a legal secretary, and but she always wanted to go to medical school. But then after she had my brother, my mom and dad kind of thought about it and said, well, it would probably be more efficient for you to go to nursing school. So I grew up kind of with her kind of guiding me and I think helping me in terms of my medical interest. And then also just growing up on a farm, the interesting thing is I saw anatomy in ways that a lot of, you know, 6 and 7 year olds didn't see it, because, you know, I was, you know, right there next to the butcher, you know, every March and November, whenever they would slaughter the cows and, you know, have a side of beef and hanging that up. And Slim would show me, you know, this is where the heart is and, you know, this is the liver and these other types of things. And I felt as if growing up on a farm and getting exposure to different types of things, I got to see science from a very practical standpoint, you know, whereas a lot of kids, you know, probably had, you know, their science experiments in classrooms. You know, I got to put cyanide tablets in water and then, you know, give that to chickens and do types of things like that that we needed to do in order to make everything function, or even putting fertilizer down or things on those lines. So I think in terms of how it guided me towards medicine is it helped me understand not just the circle of life, but understanding the importance of science in life.
Yeah. You know, I think the other thing that strikes me as really interesting about this is that I'd imagine that the experience of growing up the way you did leads to a lot of self-reliance that most of us just don't have. Because, you know, for me, the idea of having to kill my food or, you know, raise it sounds, you know, somewhat insane, even though my roommate thinks it's the greatest idea in the world. He's like, we should just get a bunch of chickens in our garage. So I wonder, what did you learn about self-reliance from that experience, and how has it played out throughout your life?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important things I learned in my childhood was, I think, a healthy mixture of self-reliance, but then also understanding the importance of growing up in a community where you are valued. So one of the things that I realized was, you know, when my dad moved our family to Michigan, you know, it wasn't, you know, as I said before, entirely because, you know, he said, hey, look, this is where I'm going to put my family. It was also because they could not really get reliable housing in Chicago. I mean, this wasn't, you know, the height of redlining, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but there was still a lot of, you know, racism and I'd say residual, you know, issues in terms of racial covenants and difficulty finding an area that would be safe to raise your kids. And so, you know, when they got a mortgage, when they got a bank that seemed reliable and seemed willing to, you know, invest in their buying the property, you know, right next door to them was another family that had moved from Chicago to the area. And then across the street was a family that also had some experience farming. And so one of those families, the Brown family, what they did was they helped my dad set up all of the fences to kind of separate the different pastures that we had there. And even though my dad, you know, grew up on a farm, you know, it had been 20 years or so in a different environment. So, you know, the people around us supported us a lot. And I felt as if it ended up becoming a symbiotic relationship, because when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, I started working on the Browns' property and picking blueberries and doing things on those lines. And one of the funniest things I think I learned from that as a child was, you know, as kind and loving as the Browns were, you know, Mr. Brown was also very strict. And so, you know, there was one day where I think it was raining. And so I got excited as a kid. I said, hey, you know, we're not going to have to go, you know, pick blueberries next door. We can go play inside or whatever. And so I called Mr. Brown and said, well, you know, it's raining, so I don't have to come over there. And he said, well, it stopped raining, so, you know, you can come over in an hour. And my older brother, who was relying on me to give him accurate information on what we're supposed to do, I told him, I said, oh, yeah, Mr. Brown said we don't have to come. And so he fired us, you know, which was pretty hilarious. And then my dad talked to him, and he rehired us. And one of the things that, you know, Mr. Brown told us when we came back a couple of days later is he said, look, you can't, you're not supposed to lie to people. You know, that's not something that you do. So that's why I said there are a lot of good life lessons that we learned from a community that valued us as members.
Yeah. Well, why do you think that we have, you know, sort of lost that symbiotic nature that you grew up with? Because, you know, I think that what strikes me as odd is that, you know, I go to my parents' house. They live, you know, in a fairly nice suburb in a relatively nice neighborhood. And I don't think I know any of their neighbors. Like, you know, I asked my friends, like, do you know who, like, yeah, we talked to them once, and it's kind of strange that, you know, you live in such close proximity and yet you have so little contact with each other. And, you know, I can't help but think of Vivek Murthy's book Together, which is all about loneliness and kind of what an impact it's had on, you know, society at large and how it's led to all these horrible things. And, you know, I kind of wonder, like, what is it that has caused us to lose that? But more importantly, how do we get it back?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It's interesting. I think if you look at a lot of the studies that compare the United States to other countries around the world, ones that, you know, collectively have lower GDPs, have you know, per person, or just, you know, as a country, and when you look at these indices of their happiness, or you look at these indices of their depression, more often than not, you know, we rank higher in terms of depression and loneliness despite the fact that we have more money. And I think part of that is we have become a society of individuals. I don't get me wrong. I mean, I studied law. I'm the member of the California Bar, you know, and I take the whole idea of individual liberties and civil liberties and freedoms very seriously. But I think there's a difference between that and this idea that at the end of the day, you're in it alone. And everyone else around you is just another person who's kind of in it alone. And so how do we get that back? I think it's like a lot of other things in life. I think it starts from the top. I think we really need strong, reliable leadership to kind of help us feel okay in those instances, and help us understand how so many different communities and societies have so much in common that it's actually better for us to reach out to people who may seem different from who we are, or our histories, and get to know something about them, as you said, with respect to your neighbors and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, I think that makes a perfect segue to, another thing that I'm very, curious about. I mean, you're an African American who has become a doctor, and I kind of wonder, one, what were race relations like while you were growing up, and how have they impacted you in your career? Do you see biases because of race? Like, do you experience things that other people don't? Because, I remember my roommate actually said he'd finished reading White Fragility, and he said, he came to the conclusion that he's like, wow, he's like, being white is, like being a, like water to a fish. You just don't ever really think about it at all.
Yeah. The interesting thing is kind of going back to what I said in the beginning, I think narrative is a very important thing, whatever the ethnicity is or society is, and that narrative can and does shape your viewpoint on your entire life. And so the narrative that my parents instilled in me, on one side, I had my dad, I'll never forget this. He told me one of the reasons that he loved Shakespeare so much was because he felt that, he could, by reading Shakespeare and understanding it, he could understand concepts that were, that transcended, race. And this is coming from someone who grew up in segregated Arkansas and, I was chased away from polls and stuff like that from the stories that he told me. The local bank would not allow an African-American to have a bank account. But part of the narrative of what my dad gave me was, look, there have been all of these different successes by African-Americans through history. If we're talking about George Washington Carver or, Martin Luther King, or, the ones that are more commonly known, but then others that are known through, a deep reading of African-American history. And so understanding that there's this narrative of being able to succeed despite some of these instances of racism that I think, has, plagued a lot of people. So in terms of me personally, I would definitely say there've been instances where I felt as if, there've been challenges that I've had to overcome because of my race.
Can you give specifics? Like, what were some of them that you recall that have been formative?
I think in terms of the specifics, I can give you a really good example. So part of what we're most concerned about in medicine is, or rather health disparities. So this idea that there are various social determinants and other factors that contribute to, and implicit and explicit bias, the outcomes for people of different ethnicities being drastically different. And so this has been studied from the standpoint of cardiovascular outcomes between African Americans and whites, or cancer survival outcomes. And so, getting back to the story about my mom, so my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer about 2.5 years ago. And she was one of the 1 in 5 people that didn't smoke that got lung cancer. I knew enough about or had enough exposure to this idea of health disparities that I said, look, you know, okay, so this is something that's happened. I'm going to try to take as much control over this care as possible so I can try to make sure that, you know, she doesn't become a statistic in this idea of health disparities. And, you know, I'll never forget a conversation that I had with a neurologist who was also a board certified neurologist that never met my mom, didn't know anything about her. And I was recounting these symptoms that she was having as an internal medicine doctor and seeing these symptoms. And the neurologist had said, well, you know, it's not uncommon for African-American women to have, you know, vascular dementia, and that's likely what this is. And it was completely the wrong diagnosis. But, and, you know, we come to find out what she actually had, which was an autoimmune encephalitis that was secondary to the lung cancer. But I raise that point to say, you know, that substantially affected our life in my viewpoint, because, you know, it required me to, you know, not just take a front role in terms of her healthcare, but then also it caused a distrust in the healthcare system for me, which had been had not been there before.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's one other part of this, you know, I'm really curious to hear your perspective on. I mean, it sounds to me like you were guided quite well. I mean, you know, if we could argue to say that, you know, you grew up in relatively privileged circumstances, not necessarily tremendous privilege per se, but then there are also people who don't, you know, who grew up in really, really difficult environments, most of which are really difficult to get out of, because I think I was reading a book the other day called The Hacking of the American Mind. And what this guy was saying was, you know, people who grew up in environments like ghettos and stuff, he's like, their chances of actually, their upward mobility is so limited because of their circumstances. And so I wonder, when you look at where you've ended up, how you think about bridging that gap between people like yourself and people who don't manage to overcome, you know, the narrative that's been so dominant.
Yeah, I mean, it takes an entire societal lift is what it does. And so I think the most recent killing of George Floyd, I think, has kind of highlighted for a lot of people the importance of society coming together. And trying to step up to the plate and do its role in this. Because even though I think it's a good thing, for example, that you would have, let's say, you know, and I'd see these in kind of one-offs here and there, you'd have a, you know, an African-American, you know, of whatever gender that gets in a certain position. And so then, you know, let's say it's in a company or a corporation, they say, okay, let's have a mentoring program, and, you know, we're going to try to reach out and try to, you know, help some others that may not have had the same you know, privileges and opportunities that you had. And so you just can't have one or two people doing that. I mean, you have to have, even if it were at a corporate level, you'd have to have the entire corporation interested in doing the corporate social responsibility, or, you know, if it's a community, the entire community looking to figure out, okay, how are we going to get, you know, better housing for people that are of lower income, you know, as opposed to relying on Section 8 or some other type of housing. So I think part of it starts with the listening that that we're beginning to have. And I think another part starts with making sure that the people that are most affected by these things are included in the conversation. You know, whether it's in policing and ensuring that you have, you know, enough African-Americans on the police force, and not just on the lower ranks, but, you know, much higher, in the ascension to, you know, higher levels of leadership, but then also making sure that the people that are most affected get constant access to the leaders that are in place, which doesn't seem to occur that frequently.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what, you know, I've noticed. It seems like there are a lot of people who have no skin in the game making policy and making decisions that aren't affected at all by the outcomes of those decisions. So, you know, with that in mind, I mean, also, we're in this very sort of polarized situation, unlike anything we've ever seen. You know, I think part of it is that people's viewpoints are so extreme, you know, the narratives are so extreme. And, you know, finding common ground and building that bridge, I think, is really, you know, something that we're struggling with. I mean, we're not, you know, able to actually do that. In fact, I just interviewed this woman who wrote a book called Hive Mind, and she talked about, you know, how tribalism is basically dividing us, but it happens on virtually every level, you know, from people like you and I to people on, you know, other sides with different opinions. So how do we get to a place of you know, sort of agreement and accord when we have such profound differences in, you know, worldviews, narratives, and all the things that have happened? And I mean, you're seeing it play out right now in the healthcare system in a way probably that most of us don't have a view of. You know, I think we just see what's on the news, but I don't think any of us really understand, particularly for those of us who lead relatively privileged lives. Like, I was talking to a friend the other day, and she said, you know, basically, we're able to take care of our kids and, you know, keep them home from school during the situation when the schools are not open. She said, well, what about people who don't have that luxury, whose parents are working outside of the home? She's like, we don't think about any of those things.
No, you're exactly right. And I think a lot of it starts with the narrative that we're willing to have as a country, and the truths that we're willing to see. And a lot of people, I think, just aren't at that point. You know, one of the best things I think my parents did for me was, you know, as a child, they said, hey, look, you know, you have your readings that you have in school, you know, you're going to read, you know, about some, you know, 13th or 14th century, you know, English poet or something. But you're also going to read Before the Mayflower, you know, which was a story of all these, or rather the history of a lot of the trials and tribulations of African Americans in the United States for the last 400 years. Or you're going to read, you know, Let the Trumpet Sound during the summer, you know, in between going out to play, which was, you know, the biography of Martin Luther King, you know, or you're going to read the autobiography of Malcolm X. You're going to read these things so that you understand that, you know, yes, there is, you know, this is a country that's unique in the sense that it was started with this idea of it being a democracy, a limited democracy at that time, because, you know, you had to be, you know, a white male landowner. But it's a democracy that, you know, has amendments to the Constitution, which, like I said, it baffles me that you have these people with these, you know, originalist mindsets that, you know, seem to ignore the fact that the whole point of the Constitution is it can be amended. But to understand that, you know, we've created a country that was not perfectly created, because it was created substantially through the labor and you know, resources and lives of people that did not give their resources and lives willingly, but that we have a history of always becoming, or in general, becoming better. You know, when you look at the amendments that gave, or the amendment rather, that gave women suffrage, or you look at the Civil Rights Act of 1965. So I think if we have, and it goes back to leadership again with me, and I, you know, maybe it's because of my military background, but if we have leadership that helps us understand why that narrative is important, that we are a country that, you know, values hard work, that understands how we were created and acknowledges that, I think it'll move us forward collectively beyond tribalism a lot more than anything else that we've seen so far.
Yeah. So you mentioned the military background, and I am always sort of intrigued by, you know, anybody who has spent time in the military and sort of trying to understand, you know, what it is that you know, drives military decisions. I mean, when you look at military and the role that it plays in, you know, our country in particular, where, you know, we spend more on it than probably anything, and yet somehow the amount of money we spend on military could actually be, you know, used to solve many of the problems that we're currently dealing with. What do you think people misunderstand, particularly people like me who only see it from the outside?
I think there's obviously I can only speak from my own perspective, but I think there's a pride, a very durable pride in knowing that as someone who served in the military, you have decided that you're going to, even to the point of sacrificing yourself, support a certain ideal and do that, you know, with other people who, at least, you know, on those in that particular, I guess, arena have the same beliefs. You know, and so one of the, I'll give you a couple of reasons as to why I joined the military. So part of it was I was in law school during when 9/11 happened, and I was in a combined degree program at Duke and kind of thinking this idea of, okay, I'll do health policy and maybe some patent law, and this will be very interesting. And it completely, you know, disrupted my worldview because I didn't know, I mean, you know, like most people, I didn't know anything about Afghanistan or, you know, very next to nothing about the Middle East. But I did know that this seemed as if this was something that was an attack on the entire United States collectively, even if I didn't know a lot of that other stuff. And so when I looked at it, I thought, well, you know, I'll be a doctor, hopefully for the rest of my life, and I'll see patients, you know, until I'm 60 something. But this can be an opportunity for me to serve the people that are going over there, you know, and doing these things with the concept or with the belief, rather, that they're supporting our ideals. And, you know, having done that with a Marine helicopter squadron, it was just a significant amount of pride. You felt as if you were doing something that was selfless and doing something that made you feel that you were giving back in a way that you could not give back otherwise. So I think a lot of the people in the military, you know, they don't look at it from the idea of, yes, this is, you know, trillions of dollars that could be spent on something else. You know, they really look at it as, you know, this is a contribution that unites people and is keeping us safe.
Yeah. Well, so with all that in mind, I mean, given where we're at now, you're a doctor, and, you know, you and I were talking before here about, you know, trying to create some semblance of a new normal within the craziness that we're dealing with. I mean, how do you see a future coming about that isn't so, you know, sort of detrimental and so damaging to people's lives? Because, you know, I think it's pretty safe to say that people are really suffering right now.
Yeah. You know, I think the only way that we're going to get there in terms of this future that is going to have less people suffering is if we really invest in those points that have been exposed by the COVID pandemic. You know, getting back to what I said before, we've known for a long time that there have been disparities in healthcare. You know, we've seen it. You know, the data is there to support that. But when the COVID pandemic hit in the beginning, there were, in some instances, you know, 2 to 3 times more African-Americans and Hispanics and Native Americans getting infected than their white counterparts. Even younger African-Americans, in some instances, were up to 10 times more likely to die. Right. And so part of that, you know, we can say, okay, that may be an artifact of the healthcare system, access to healthcare. But the other artifact of that is that you have, in some instances, these people, they're living in low income, crowded communities, or are essential workers, or in transit, can't socially distance on a train or these other types of things. And those things being exposed by the pandemic, I think lets us see what are the, you know, canaries in the coal mine, so to speak, in terms of our broader socioeconomic dynamic. You know, and if that doesn't change, then the next pandemic, the same thing's going to happen again, and the one after that, and the one after that. But, you know, we're not going to move away from, you know, being a capitalistic society. And even if we did, I'm not sure that would be the solution. But I think if we, you know, really look at the history of how certain things have come about and invest in those areas that, you know, we've not invested in, whether it is, you know, ensuring that we have reliable housing for people that hadn't because of, you know, decades and decades of redlining or Jim Crow laws or racism and these other types of things, or, you know, the odd thing that's happened in the last, you know, 25 years where we've removed a lot of funding from mental health institutions, and you have a lot of people who have mental health issues on the streets. And in some instances, up to, in some cities, up to 40% of those people are veterans from the last 20 years of war, right? So I think it starts with us acknowledging that some of our lack of attention and lack of investment in these areas has exacerbated these problems, and then having a willingness to actually invest the money in those areas so that we can move forward and this doesn't happen again.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the bigger question, and this actually I think applies not just to sort of society at large, but even on an individual level, why do you think it is that we have to be pushed to like a boiling point to actually have anything change? Because I was asking somebody this question the other day about politics and how, you know, Michael Moore had this movie where, you know, in other countries, for example, where college is tuition free, and the moment they put a tuition hike in, people take to the streets, and here people don't do a damn thing. They're just kind of, you know, sitting lazily on their, you know, sprawling lawns at their expensive campuses. Why is it that it takes that for us to actually do something to change, you know, whether as a society or even on an individual level?
You know, I think this is a question that we've asked ourselves as doctors for a really long time, because we see this on a micro level. You know, it's like I'll have a conversation with the same patient about their blood pressure or about some other related thing, and nothing's really done until, unfortunately, you know, they have a heart attack. So, you know, I wouldn't say it's necessarily, you know, human nature, because kind of to your point, you can see in other societies, people may be a little bit more willing to, go to the streets. But I feel as if, you know, every society will have its norms in terms of people kind of lulling themselves into a false sense of comfort, you know, whatever that may be, you know. And it's not until you are substantially disrupted from that I think people feel as if there's enough of a price, so to speak, to be paid for them to do nothing. And so on a micro level, it may be, and they kind of get to this in the whole idea of motivational interviewing in medicine, you know, trying to figure out what is it that you value the most that would make you change your behavior. And so for some people, it may be, you know, avoiding that heart attack. For other people, it may be, making sure that they can, you know, still get to play softball with their kid into their 50s or 60s or something, and making sure that they don't have the back pain and other issues that are associated with that. But I think, you know, collectively, when you look at all of the different things that we have in our society that kind of creates this, you know, for some people, almost a cocoon, that separates them from needing to make hard decisions. It's not until that is completely disrupted or taken away from them, or the threat of that being taken away from them, that sometimes they have, I think, the energy and the will to act.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of heart attacks, you know, there's one other thing I think that I find interesting is that somebody has this sort of traumatic thing saying they're going to value their life or whatever it is, you know, and then they go back to their old behaviors. Why does that happen? Like, what causes that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's just the fact that, you know, we have very bad memories, it's like, why do people, say that they're going to quit something and then they go right back to doing it? Or, you know, why do people in some instances find themselves in bad friendships, leave those friendships and then come back? I think it's hard for us, again, to kind of move ourselves away from what feels comfortable. And, you know, there's been some studies that even, I think, reinforces the idea of implicit bias. You know, it's like, you know, explicit bias, racism, I mean, that's kind of easy to call out, right? I mean, you know, you have someone, you know, with a hood over their head and you know, the caricature of the KKK member or whatever. I mean, that's easy. But, you know, even from a neurobiological standpoint, there seems to be a suggestion that people have so many implicit biases because it's easier to end up, you know, lumping people together and you know, these collective, I think, categories in terms of their behavior, and use that as a quick assessment of, you know, how they're going to interact with someone. So I think, you know, trying to move us away from those types of things, you know, whether it's, you know, from a health standpoint, and the things that make you comfortable. You know, you're more comfortable eating similar meals all the time than you would be changing it, or more comfortable, you know, interacting with the same people all the time and not needing to have that disrupted. I think that comfort is what keeps us from being willing to be challenged in certain instances, and challenged, you know, in healthy ways.
Well, I want to wrap by kind of talking about how we deal with the sort of mental health issues that are being caused by this, because you know you alluded to it earlier, and I think I was telling you before we hit record officially that you know we've had this very unusual situation in Boulder where college students came back and then they basically said we're banning gatherings of any size for everybody who is 18 to 22, and. You know, we're like, okay, yeah, some of these people are being idiots and going to big parties. But my thought after that was like, how can you actually think that this is going to not cause some serious damage in the long run to socially isolate people like that? I mean, gatherings of any size was, in my mind, like almost a bit too far.
Yeah, it's just not enforceable. I mean, you know, you don't have the police force that could do that. And then it ends up becoming arbitrary. You know, it's like the example that you gave of just someone randomly walking down the street with their significant other and they get $1,000 fine. Whereas one street over, someone could be doing the same thing. And, you know, it's just, they're not caught. I think, you know, and I sympathize with the public health officials and the government officials in trying to figure out what would be the right balance. But I think the only way that we're going to get to that point where we have what would be a comfortable balance for enough people is if, you know, we're willing to acknowledge all of the different trade-offs that come out of these decisions, or at least enough of them for people to be able to make informed decisions. You know, one of the things that I think I start and finish my ideas about medicine and the healthcare system with is this idea of giving the patient as much information as possible to make an informed decision. As you're probably aware, medicine has been rife with paternalism that's substantially affected negatively people's outcomes. You know, that paternalism has been there for various reasons. And so, you know, I would have people, I'd hear this conversation from people in which they'd say, well, you know, if the health officials say, you know, 50 million people could be infected by COVID in 2 months, and that's wildly inaccurate. They're like, well, you know, whatever it takes to get people to stay at home. And I sit there and say, no, that doesn't make any sense. You know, lying to people just so that you get the outcome, you know, this whole, the means justify or the end justifies the means, so to speak, is just, it's not okay. It's not what we should be doing as a society. It assumes that people are, you know, cattle and can only be, you know, herded in one direction. If we give them, you know, a certain amount of information that may or may not be true, as long as it gets them to do what we want them to do. So I think in this particular case, you know, being honest with people in terms of what the COVID risk is, but then also informing people of what the risks of some of these other things, the mental health issues are, and making sure that we have the resources in place to support them. You know, I haven't read every line of the CARES Act. I mean, and there's some great stuff in there, but I don't know how much of it is in there to really support some of the mental health challenges that have come out of the isolation that we've had to do in some instances. And in some instances, not as much, but people have done it, you know, obviously because of the fear.
Yeah. No, I mean, I saw it firsthand because, you know, like when roommates and I, you know, any one of us goes out of town to do something, like we kind of said, all right, for the sake of all of our safety, it's like a 1 week quarantine. And I remember by the end of the week, I was losing my mind, even though we're in the same house, you know, and it was shocking how difficult that was.
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, multiply that times months on months and months. And then the really scary thing that, you know, people are saying, well, okay, there's a vaccine coming out, but maybe it's coming out too fast and, you know, maybe I won't get it. And I think I saw one poll that said up to 30 to 40% of people say they're not going to get it. That's why I said this is something that can last for a very long time. And getting back to what I just mentioned in terms of misinformation or you know, false information, unless we have accurate information out there, people are not going to trust what they need to trust in order to help us get out of this situation.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been really, really fascinating. I mean, it's kind of a dive into sort of a combination of race, life outcomes, and healthcare all in sort of one conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What it is, I want to make sure I understand the question. So what do I think makes someone unmistakable?
Yeah.
I think it's their outlook on life. You know, I think it's their natural energy. You know, I've had, I think, the privilege of coming across a ton of people from multitudes of lives, you know, from India, the Middle East, from the United States, and seeing someone who has just a certain, you know, energy and excitement about life, to me makes them unmistakable, because that's the type of person that I think, you know, no matter what situation you put them in within reason, they're always going to figure out a way to make the best of it. And I think that's one of the best of human qualities.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your wisdom, story, and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
No, thanks a lot, Srinivas. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. So as of right now, you know, there's a lot of content that I have online in various areas. It's not all collected in one area. I mean, there's, you know, I have my LinkedIn profile and my Twitter, Kermit Jones, MDJD. There's a lot out there that people can find in terms of YouTubes and other things and articles. I'm working on getting it all in one central place. Hopefully, talking to you will kind of increase the demand for that. But it's not that hard to find, because thankfully for me, there are not a lot of people named Kermit Jones out there, Kermit that isn't green, and then also that are doctors and lawyers. So,
yeah. Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.